through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Jake and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Ross.
Got a fun show for you guys today. Scott Service going to join us for the Scott Service Show at 1 p.m. Going to learn a little bit more about this year's Mariners. We've got questions about Kyle Lewis, who's expected to resume baseball activities any day now, so we'll be sure to ask him about that. By the way, Mariners insider Shannon Dreyer is going to join us for that interview. It's a quick turnaround for Scott, by the way, for Service. Sorry, Scott and I are tight. We're like really good friends, so I sometimes forget that you guys don't know him as well.
Yeah, that's right.
My bad.
You guys neighbors?
Yeah. That's exactly right.
I've heard somebody is a neighbor of his.
So that's coming up at 1 p.m. We've also got another draft profile today. Before we get to any of that, guys, last night was Bad News Bears. And I say that very intentionally because Baylor completely dominated the Zags. And I was expecting a much closer game. Everyone was expecting a much closer game. Most people, in fact, were expecting the Zags to win. They were the most popular pick by Vegas odds, by brackets, whatever it is, to win the championship. Nope, never even came close. Because when I say that the Zags fell short of the perfect season and that Baylor won the men's basketball championship, what I mean is that they were throttled. It wasn't even close. They were dominated by the Baylor Bears, and Baylor absolutely earned that. And if there's one thing, and Jake, we're going to jump into some more reaction from this and a look forward as well. If there's one thing I hate from the night, it's the idea that Gonzaga must have then been overrated the entire time. No, Baylor was just that good.
They were that good. They were really, really impressive last night. I mean, they were deep. They were incredible in terms of the way that they shot the ball, the way that they played defense. They were the best defensive team in all of college basketball over the entire year. And really, the thing that was hard to watch, Stacy, is you look at Gonzaga, who, I mean, is an incredible basketball team in their own right. And it looked like, I mean, you could make the argument, well, maybe they were just emotionally drained from the game that they had in the Final Four over UCLA. Whatever the case may be, they were completely shell-shocked with what Baylor presented to them at the beginning of the game. Mm-hmm. The Baylor Bears walked up to them. They were like the schoolyard bully and took their lunch money, and the Gonzaga Bulldogs didn't know how to respond. They did not know how to act.
They looked tired. Like, minutes into the game, they look gassed. Well, maybe it was the turnovers.
I just feel like they weren't emotionally ready to match the intensity level of what Baylor came in with.
No.
And I do think that there's an aspect of it. If you're the Baylor Bears, like, you had a lot of respect and notoriety about your team, but everybody coming into that game was talking about the darlings of Gonzaga and how great this basketball team is and how they have an opportunity to, you know, they are on the verge of etching their team legacy with one of the all-time great teams in all of college basketball. That was more of the conversation heading into the championship game than it was about necessarily how great this matchup was going to be. And if you're the Baylor Bears, you're thinking, forget that. Forget that. You're thinking of like Adia Barnes and the Arizona Wildcats, Curtis, right? Coming
not
in with that type of
apologizing.
Not apologizing.
Forget everybody.
Exactly. Forget everybody. We're going to come in here. We're going to dominate the Zags, who like to play a clean brand of basketball, but we're going to come in and bully these guys. And that's exactly what it looked like. And Gonzaga was never really able to fully recover from that.
Never.
But there were times, though. Gonzaga there for like 10 minutes in the early second half, they were able to get themselves in range where they were flirting with 9 points, 11 points, 10 points, 9 points, 11 points, and then Baylor would hit a big shot or they would go on another run and then just expand the lead a little bit more. Gonzaga never was able to really threaten in that game, and partly to me it was the difference in the rebounding, turnovers, three-point shooting. I mean, you talk about the, you know, Gonzaga, what they've been great at. They've been a great all-around team. Their field goal percentage was high because they were getting a bunch of twos. Mm-hmm. But Baylor was shooting lights out from the three-point range. They finished with 43.5%. But in the first half, they were like almost 50% from the three-point range,
yep.
And Gonzaga finishes the game at 29.4%. Corey Kispert, your All-American player, was a non-factor, absolute non-factor. And to me, that was a huge difference in the game. If Corey Kispert hits a couple three-point shots, you might actually get yourself down into a place where it's a five-point, three-point, two-point game. They were never able to get anywhere near striking range.
Yeah, if there were the three stats to take away, because I feel like the field goal percentage in general, which is a very kind of broad stat that often doesn't narrow down an issue, but Gonzaga technically outperformed there. But you're right. When you look at three-point percentage, 43.5 for Baylor, 29.4 for the Zags. Then you look at rebounds, 5 offensive rebounds for Gonzaga compared to 16 offensive rebounds and 38 rebounds for Baylor. And then also, of course, particularly early story of that, the early part of the game was turnovers, 14 total turnovers for Gonzaga compared to 9 for Baylor. I mean,
it was brutal. So it was really tough to watch. And I think that when you get into these types of matchups, I hate to see people react to it as, you know, Baylor was just simply that much better in the sense of if they played a series, and I know Brock Huber was talking about this or tweeting out about it last night, is in a series, he put out a poll of, you know, how many games do you think Gonzaga wins? And I view it as Gonzaga would win 3 to 4 games. I think they have a chance to win the series. I think that it is an even matchup between the Zags and Baylor, but that's not what happens in college basketball. You get one shot, one kill. That's why you get so many great games, so many great memories, so many great upsets in March Madness, in the tournament, because you only get one shot at it. And with Gonzaga, when you have one shot to make history, one shot to win a national championship, and you come up short like this, it's going to hurt. It's going to sting. Because to me, talent-wise, they're talented enough to make it happen. But they were not ready to match that same level of energy, intensity that Baylor brought out. And I'm not sitting here today going, oh, Gonzaga's a better team. They could have won. They should have won. None of that. Baylor won this thing fair and square, hands down. Not even close. Didn't leave a second doubt. There was no regrets from the Baylor Bears.
Yeah, you can't say Baylor was like underrated per se because they were also a one seed. And how often do we get a tourney where, and Curtis, you've pointed this out, two teams that we thought were the best two teams in men's college hoops last year and the tourney is canceled, end up meeting again in this year's tourney. They aren't upset by a Cinderella story. They actually meet all the way, get there all the way, and it just so happened the game wasn't nearly kind of the game that we were all expecting. But you, Curtis, were talking about it, and you were like, there's a narrative I hate.
Yeah, it's that Gonzaga is, quote-unquote, choke artist for losing last night. You don't choke in a game where you were blown out from the start. Like, that's not a choke. A choke is when you have a late lead and you cough it up through unforced errors. This Gonzaga team is not a choke artist because they somehow lost to a better team. Like, that's not what the definition of a choke artist is. And there is, I think that is a very tired narrative surrounding Gonzaga's program. Obviously, they choked back in 2006, losing to UCLA, but that was 15 years ago. Like, this is a team in their two national title game appearances lost to the better team. They lost to North Carolina in 2017, and they lost last night to Baylor. You cannot say that Gonzaga was better than Baylor, especially after last night's game.
No.
You cannot. That is not a choke.
I think it's only because, obviously, they were completely dominated, but what are some of the talking points that people have been saying about Gonzaga? Oh, they've never won by single digits. They've been leading by double digits, winning by double digits. You know what I mean? The idea was Gonzaga can be behind with minutes left to play and you aren't panicked because it's Gonzaga. And so I think because that idea was challenged and it wasn't a close game with this last second shot the way that it was in the Final Four against UCLA for the Zags, it was a game that was never close. That was pretty consistently Baylor with a double-digit lead. But I agree with you, Curtis. And that's what Titus and Tate, Mark Titus and Tate Frazier, who joined us from the Titus and Tate podcast yesterday, it's kind of what they were pointing to, right? With the idea that people outside of Washington would look at Gonzaga and be like, well, they're in a conference where they aren't getting tested. How many games against like real opponents are they playing? And you hated to know following this game that some people who think that feel like they're right after it. Like, I hate that they have that validation when it's not actually legit.
Well, but let's talk about where Gonzaga is as a program, though. This is not some plucky team anymore. This is not some, you know, group that has just come together for, you know, a one series of players. Like, usually in high school football or in college, you have some of these random universities that will have great teams that put, you know, pump out a great team here or there because of, you know, the way that everything just worked out recruiting wise. You know, they just grew up together, all that, all everything came together at the right time. And then you don't see them anymore. Like, great example. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. Coach with the Celtics right now.
Brad Stevens.
Yeah, Brad Stevens, Butler. Okay, so Butler. They're another good example of that. Have we heard of Butler getting to the national championship or the Final Four of the Elite Eight? No, it was a group of, you know, you have Gordon Hayward, you have a bunch of other talented guys, grew up together, and they have an amazing run. Gonzaga has entered a new realm. They are not a plucky team or a group that's just going to be there every now and then. Gonzaga is here to stay. And I believe fully that Gonzaga is going to get another shot at another couple shots at this run. But one thing that has to remain true for them to be able to get over the hump and to be able to actually win a national title is the fact it's not, to me, their schedule. I think that is a tremendous myth. Them playing in the WCC and how that doesn't allow them to play against tough opponents. They play as tough of a non-conference schedule as you can ask for. They played a very tough you know, round of teams through the tournament. They fared very, very well. They played some of the hottest teams in the tournament. USC demolished them. UCLA came down to a great game, but UCLA was the hottest team.
UCLA also now topping power or way too early power rankings from ESPN.
Yeah, we'll see if Johnny Yucheng ends up declaring for the draft or not. I think that'll determine that. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. You look at them right now, and obviously everybody's thinking very differently about UCLA. But my point being is that the one thing that stands in their way is truly physical teams. Teams that get in your face, in your grill, and that have the size and athleticism to match it, that's where Gonzaga has struggled in the past. And I don't know what they're going to have to do to get over that, to change that, but Mark Few's got to look at that. I don't know if it's a mindset, you know, deal, whatever the case may be, but you cannot have somebody walk into that game and it be so visible that one side is just mentally ready to go and the other side is not. And that's how I viewed this game. Baylor walked into the gym from the very beginning looking and seeking some blood. Like, they smelled blood in the water and they went for it. And Gonzaga, I think that they just kind of got into their press clippings a little bit.
Yeah,
they were looking at themselves and just kind of said, we'll walk out there. We're talented. We'll get this going and we're just going to come out here with this win instead of feeling the intensity and the gravity of the moment and going for
it. That was missing. Because if Gonzaga would have lost to UCLA, let's just say alternate reality, they would have lost to UCLA, I would have still watched that game and said Gonzaga played well. Like, Gonzaga went out there and really gave it their all and played well. And that's what was so good about that game, that Final Four game, was both teams legitimately played at 110%. This didn't feel like the Gonzaga team that I had been seeing. This wasn't Gonzaga playing at 110% and Baylor was that much better. This was Baylor being great and dominating. I will take nothing away from Baylor. They proved that they were the better team, period, yeah. Point blank. It just didn't quite have the same intensity from Gonzaga as they did against UCLA. That's what was weird about
right.
it.
And to Baylor's credit, they took a team that was just as talented as them, that matched up very, very well with them, and they basically put them and shoved them in a locker. Like, that's what they did. And Gonzaga didn't know how to react, how to respond, how to come together. And, you know, the only one, to his credit, that really stepped up after a very brutal 8 minutes of basketball was Jalen Suggs. After that, he responded. He played. He played right there with Baylor, you know, for the remainder of the game. But that, to me, was the biggest disappointment of the night. That they couldn't get Timmy going. They kept putting him in bad positions, you know, switching off on screens. I mean, that, to me, how did you not make that adjustment? There were a lot of aspects of this game that were just so hard to watch, because I really do feel like if it was a game of a game seven series, I think Gonzaga and Baylor, they go blow for blow, and they have a very good series that probably goes to a game seven, game six. I don't think that Baylor is just that much better than Gonzaga, but they showed up last night, and they were ready for the moment, and the Zags were not whatsoever.
I have an announcement to make. Are you ready for it?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Here's my announcement. I want you guys to stay tuned to 710 ESPN Seattle all morning because we're giving away a pair of Mariners tickets every hour until noon. Listen for the cue to call and you could win a pair of tickets to tomorrow afternoon's Mariners White Sox matinee at T-Mobile Park. Tonight marks James Paxton's first start back in a Mariners uniform, and tomorrow is the first midweek matinee of the season. So get your tickets at Mariners.com. It's time for Three Questions, brought to you by Tila Mortgage.
It's time for Three Questions.
Can't wait for it.
Every day at 11:15, three burning questions for Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
That's the dumbest question you could ask. What?
Question one, what's a better feeling as a sports fan? Watching your team rise to contender status or being the team everyone is gunning for?
I think here's what's fun about being the team on the rise. I had a chance to do it when I was a sophomore in high school at Skyline, and we were a team that no one really counted on. We were, you know, top 10 or just outside of it, and we ended up winning state that year. That was so much fun because there was no pressure, no expectations. The following 2 years, number one in the state, we had high expectations, and there's a lot more pressure when you're trying to defend a title. So if you're Gonzaga, I think that that's the position that you were in last night. You started to become the darling. You started to become the favorite. You were the one that had your target on your back. And Baylor came hunting, and you didn't know how to match that level of intensity. Whereas before, they've kind of been the plucky team where, hey, whatever happens with Gonzaga, yeah, hey, it's all great. It's roses. No one's really expecting anything from you. So there's definitely, I think it's the better feeling when you actually win when it's unexpected. It's just there's so much more drama and excitement, and just it's a lot of fun.
It's so fun, and that's what we're conditioned, not just as sports fans, but just as consumers of media and consumers of stories to love. Like, tell me one movie that's about a team that, like, is dominant and then has to maneuver their way around, like, salary cap constraints to stay dominant. Like, no. The best movies, the best stories we're told are about the rise, about the journey, about the chase. Like, those are more exciting. I genuinely love those stories more, and those are also the stories you grew up watching. So, of course, that's more fun as a sports fan. It is so much more fun to watch your team rise and watch your team surprise people and watch your team finally make it and finally climb the mountain. The rest of it's great. Like, the rest of it, staying on the mountain and trying to find a way to beat other people down from it, that's fine, but that's not the same story.
Quentin Dunbar on his way to play for the Lions. See you never. What's one move a team has made that you were excited about that ultimately never worked out?
So any team where we were like, let's see how this works out.
Let's see.
How about Ziggy Ansah, Jake?
Dang. That cuts deep.
I got him.
Yeah, you did.
Never forget the day
that hurt.
Chest bumped each other.
You know what? You're right, though, because
so excited.
What could have happened if Ziggy Ansah wasn't just an absolute shell of himself physically, and that he came to Seattle and he was able to put together some years that he performed in Detroit and been one of the more dominant defensive pass rushers in football? I mean, it would have been really, really fun to watch Ansah healthy paired with Jadeveon Clowney. Those would be two game wreckers. So when you look at it from that aspect, I think Ziggy Ansah is definitely the one for me. Just thinking, what if? But I should have known better coming off of, you know, multiple shoulder injuries that, you know, he was really going on the next, an entirely different phase of his career.
What about having guys like Robinson Cano and Nelson Cruz with the Mariners? Like, it's not like they didn't. Nelson Cruz was still really good when he was here, but the problem is that your team as a whole. And so is Cano, but the problem is, like, imagine having two guys like that on a team that is a contender, and you get to watch just these powerful dudes just, like, hit home run, like, 450-yard homers. And I just would have liked it to correspond with something that was great. That's more what it is for me. It's when greatness doesn't correspond with success for a team.
So like
when
Felix
at his best didn't correspond with the Mariners at their best. Imagine if those two would have corresponded, how phenomenal that would have been.
So like Jimmy Graham.
Exactly. Like the best Seahawks tight end this team has ever had corresponding with the team getting to a Super Bowl solely on the back of Jimmy Graham. You're right, Jake. That's exactly right. Thank you.
Number three.
Last night's game, a clunker. So what's the last hyped up game you can think of that fell way short of expectations?
Fell way short of expectations, man. Well, I mean, the Super Bowl most recently, right? I mean, that one was supposed to be a great game. You were supposed to see Tom Brady and Patrick Mahomes battling back and forth. And really, it was a blowout from start to finish. So I think the Super Bowl was definitely one of them that you could talk about. How about the Super Bowl between the Seattle Seahawks and the Denver Broncos? That was a very hyped Super Bowl. Number one offense versus number one defense. Not even close. As we know, and we all loved it here in Seattle. That was a great day for everyone in Seattle. Those two are the ones that come, you know, first and foremost in my mind.
I'm laughing at someone correct because I accidentally said 450 yard home run.
It's like a 1,200 foot home run.
Just
that'd be a new record.
Mr. Cruz, can we please see you for some testing here?
No kidding.
In a minute? Please step aside. Oh, geez, Louise. Yeah, I think Rams-Patriots Super Bowl, the most recent Super Bowl. Super Bowls, more often than not, to me, have felt lackluster. Like, when's the last time there was a Super Bowl? The Eagles-Patriots was really good, but I'm trying to think of the last time there was a Super Bowl where you guys thought that met expectations.
Or how about remember the Patriots-Rams matchup?
Yeah, it was boring. It was horrible.
So
and I made
10,
so
10
much
to 3.
Good food.
Oh, that was...
So much good food.
That was brutal. Or how about any like pay-per-view MMA fight or boxing match?
Boxing matches always underwhelm people. I constantly, half of Twitter is always like, are you kidding me? I paid for that.
I've never understood why anybody pays for pay-per-view matchups, because you spend,
you're flushing what? $70 down the
toilet. Yeah, 70, yep. 50, 50 to 70 bucks for what? For a minute, most, maybe even 5 minutes of a match? That's brutal. Absolutely brutal.
All right. Well, we're going to keep the conversation going about the NCAA Men's Championship, Gonzaga's heartbreaking loss. Let's ask the Groz about it. He is a guy who knows all about college hoops and is able to add some historical context to all this. That's next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacey.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacey Rost.
All right, we want to send you guys to tomorrow afternoon's Mariners game. So, in 1 minute, if you're listening on the radio, or 30 seconds if you're listening on the stream, here's what I want you to do. I want you to call 206-421-3776 or 866-979-3776. Caller number
3.
Caller number 3 will win a pair of tickets to see the Mariners take on the White Sox tomorrow afternoon. Don't forget, baseball's back at T-Mobile Park. Get your tickets at mariners.com. Once again, that number is 206-421-3776 or 866-979-3776. Caller number 3 now. Joining us today is the Groz, brought to you by Jafco Plumbing and Sewer. Groz, I got to say, I wish we were joined by you under better circumstances, able to talk about a Zags win. Unfortunately, they were just throttled by Baylor. Did you see this coming at all? Because I didn't.
No. I'd be lying if I said I did. But, you know, it clearly they were a better team. I mean, there was just little to argue otherwise. I understand people thinking, well, that game against UCLA might have taken something out of them. But, you know, that looked like it was going to be a difficult matchup. They were supposed to play, of course, during the regular season. And if they had, that would have been a little more obvious. But, no, I didn't see that freight train coming, and neither did the Bulldogs.
Now, Groz, you talk about that freight train, and was it one of those things that you look at the way that they played? Is it more of what Baylor did, or the fact that Gonzaga did really nothing to respond and get themselves truly back in that game?
I think Baylor jumped them and stayed on top of them the whole way. You know, I think Gonzaga tried to get back into it, and you know they definitely started slowly, but you know, boom, it was a double digit game within about 2 minutes. And I think, you know, no matter what, it changes your mentality a little bit. And Baylor kept hitting shots throughout. They kept the pressure on. So I really credit them more. I think that they played exceptionally well. And Gonzaga was just unable to get back into the game. And that was because of what Baylor was doing. I don't think Gonzaga had their best night either. But I do think that really the credit goes to Baylor. And you know, getting off to that start, just blasting them out at the beginning, just took Gonzaga seemingly out of their game for the rest of the night.
Now, Graz, is this a moment that Gonzaga can truly recover from or make themselves better out of this moment? It seems that I don't want to say that they get up against tougher competition. I would just say the right matchup. A team like Baylor, a team like North Carolina from a couple years ago, lengthwise they can match up with them, but they also play extremely physical. Is that a moment that Mark Few looks at this and goes, hey, we've got to change something? Or do you think that it's just more of, hey, can we find the right group that can eventually get it done?
I think it's more the latter, Jake. I mean, I think you're looking at this year, and if you look at that non-conference, they beat Kansas, they beat Iowa, they beat West Virginia, you know, they beat Virginia, all teams that made the NCAA tournament. They play a good non-conference schedule. Their conference is what it is. But you know, they were undefeated going into the championship game, which is the first team to do that, to actually be undefeated playing in the championship game, since Indiana did it and won against Michigan 45 years ago, and it's been 45 years since an undefeated team did that. So if I'm Mark Few, I'm not seeing anything that's broken. I mean, I'm not seeing anything that's broken. I'm seeing, boy, it was a difficult matchup with Baylor, and it was still a great season, and we are definitely where we want to be and where we need to be, and it's just a question of playing the best game when it matters the most, and I think that's the thing. Ultimately, you know, winning all those games in a row, as the Patriots found out a few years ago as well, doesn't mean anything if you don't win that last game. And I don't know if they put too much of a premium on the undefeated season. I think they probably did not. But it's not anything to put a premium on. The important thing is winning a championship.
I'm going to jump conferences here, take a look at the Pac-12. Not only did the Pac-12 women show up with basically an all Pac-12 final there, yeah. Congratulations Stanford on their win. Looking at the ESPN had their way too early rankings for men's. UCLA right there. If they weren't at the top in a couple other polls, they were a top five program elsewhere. Do you think they were just kind of like criminally underrated because the powers that be don't watch as much Pac-12? Or do you think that they just showed up late in the season and in the tourney in a way that they hadn't before?
Stacey, it was really unbelievable because they didn't show up late in the year. They lost their last four games. So they went staggering into the tournament as an 11 seed. Had they not lost their last four, they would have been higher seeded. And then in that play-in game against Michigan State, they're down 14 in the first half. I mean, they are finished. They played lousy for a month. They're done. And it's just the beauty of college sports. I mean, you know, Mick Cronin said something or something happened in the locker room at the halftime of that Michigan State game, and presto, you had a different team. And, you know, I think, too, you know, you can't take anything away from that game. I think the takeaway from this year, 10, 15, 20 years from now, is not going to be so much the championship game that Gonzaga lost. It's going to be that UCLA-Gonzaga game, which I think, as time passes by, is going to go down as one of the great college basketball games ever played. It was just it was good for 40 minutes. It wasn't just a close finish. It was a great game the entire way. So, no, I think UCLA caught everyone. And if Mick Cronin was honest, he'd say he was surprised too, because they had played so lousy right at the end of the year, and then had played that terrible first half in their play-in game. I mean, to see them doing what they did was beyond belief. And, you know, you're right. The Pac-10 women played great, but UCLA played well. They couldn't get past Gonzaga. Oregon State was the team that won the Pac tournament, and they played well. So it was a surprisingly, surprisingly good tournament for the Pac-12, really out of the blue.
Graz, we're looking at certain things with the Mariners just step by step, incrementally. We're asking ourselves little questions here or there about what can we learn or what can we see. We're going to see James Paxton on the mound for the first time tonight. What are you looking or expecting to see from Paxton?
I want to see the guy that we saw here the first time around, and then saw that full year he played with the Yankees 2 years back when he won 16 games. So you're looking for the fastball in the mid-90s, good control of the breaking ball. If Paxton looks like he has looked, you know, you're not asking – he's the one guy you're not asking for him to be something that he's not. Or let me put it a different way. You're not asking him to do something that he hasn't done yet, which you're kind of asking those young guys to do, and that's the way it is with young players. With James Paxton, you want to see him be the pitcher that he has been, especially with the Yankees and in his last year here. So I think you're looking for that in particular. Velocity is something you look at with him. And just we all know his easy motion. We remember what he looks like. We remember what he looks like when he's going well. And I think that's what you're looking for today. So it's just James Paxton, a guy who pitches to the back of his baseball card, as you put it, you know, as opposed to a guy who's trying to do something he hasn't done. And it would be very nice to see.
Graz, we love hearing from you. Thanks for taking the time and talking to us today.
Thank you guys very much. Talk to you soon.
See ya. Congratulations, by the way, to this hour's winner, Neil in Kirkland. Have fun at that game tomorrow. All right, speaking of that game, we've got three questions heading into this Mariners series against the White Sox. I know the series opener has already happened, so we've still got some questions that we want to have answered. We'll tell you what they are next.
You're listening to Jake and Stacy,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Jake Heaps and Stacy Rost.
Seattle Mariners continue their series against the Chicago White Sox. So, Jake, I have been pondering three questions that we have for the Mariners series. All right. Now, the number one question, Graz actually brought it up in our last segment with him, which is, what is James Paxton going to look like? He makes his debut tonight. Curtis, do you remember how many he struck out combined over those two games? Isn't it like 17?
17 and 8 1/3 innings pitch.
Unreal performance, an unreal spring for James Paxton. I think everyone's wondering how much of that he's going to bring into this second stint with the Mariners, which officially begins tonight. I think that one of the things you're going to be hoping for if you don't have a ton of pop from your offense is that pitching is pretty solid. So far, it's been a little up and down. I don't expect Marco to have kind of a dud outing the second time around. I think that was kind of uncharacteristic for him. Normally he's a model of consistency. Likewise, Kikuchi, I don't know if he's always going to have as dominant as an outing as he had. However, I think you'd like to see a guy where more often than not you can look at him to at least bring you something that night, give you a chance that night. So tonight we're going to find out if Paxton can maybe be that.
Well, and that's what's so hard about what we asked some of these questions, and look, James Paxton's first start, you see Sheffield's first start, it did not go very well for him whatsoever. Marco Gonzalez's first start didn't go well. So in terms of the starting pitching, it hasn't necessarily been stellar first time around, but you hope that obviously they continue to make adjustments as the season goes on. But James Paxton, it would be great to see him from the jump to be able to come out healthy, you know, have his stuff, be ready to go. And as we saw in spring training, the one start that he did have, he looked fantastic. And if you can have a stabilizing force within that rotation, that would just mean so much to this group, so much to Scott Servais. And as you said, Stacy, knowing that at least for one night, and hopefully more than just one night, but one night in that rotation, you've got somebody as solid as James Paxton at his best. It would be a really good feeling for the Mariners, you know, walking in through the course of the season, from here on out. So I'm really pulling for Paxton, and I want to see him, you know, perform really, really well.
I feel like I got to preface all of this by saying these are questions we have that aren't necessarily going to be answered. It's the second series of a very, very long season, a somewhat back to normal season in terms of the games that you're playing. But These are still questions that we're going to carry into it. So you got the debut of Paxton tonight. Understandably, we're wondering how he's going to look tonight. Second question. There isn't the debut here, per se, of anything, but what we're wondering is whether the offense is going to show some pop. And Curtis, you mentioned this. Is the offense going to show up and put forth a respectable effort? Something they've been able to do, draw a couple walks. They've looked pretty good there. But consider this. This is from Nathan Bishop. Curtis pointed this out to me. From Nathan Bishop, he's got the Dome and Bedlam podcast, covers the Mariners. He said, the Mariners have 3 hits and 14 strikeouts tonight, 24 hits and 53 strikeouts in 37 innings on the season.
Not good.
Not good. It's not great. It's what we call not ideal.
There's room for improvement.
It's a kind of a stat. It's a lesser known stat called the not ideal stat.
Okay.
NI. This falls into that.
Well, I would say that when you talk about the approach at the plate and what I saw this lineup as potentially being, there's one obvious hole in this, and that is Kyle Lewis, right? And we'll see what ends up happening when he comes back into the lineup. But you would hope that Seager, Ty France, you know, you saw a good game from Mitch Haniger last night, but you'd like to see that be more consistent. And so, you know, overall, like we said, this is early on in the series. Everybody is just getting comfortable, getting their feet wet, and get into the groove of everything. But so far, not a good start. Not a good start. And when we talk about controlling the zone, that's not something that Scott Servais necessarily would like to see.
Well, and you kind of have, for instance, J.P. Crawford didn't have like a really hot bat in spring, wasn't stellar. You were hoping that would somehow creep a little bit higher for him during the season, but he hasn't had a really, really hot start. And then you've had Ty France, who looked really hot in spring, who has been good, but not quite as good as he was in spring. So you kind of had two things. You were thinking that maybe they would both go toward the average. Instead, you've had guys that struggled in spring who haven't quite picked it up yet, and then guys who were really great in spring that haven't quite met that bar. So it's just, it hasn't been great at the plate. But obviously, the hope is to see that turn around. Last question here, and this is one that we're going to bring up when Scott Servais joins us at 1, Jake, but it's how soon can Kyle Lewis come back?
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, you just miss the talent of Kyle Lewis in this lineup. You miss him being able to be there and being a stabilizing force for this group and putting everybody in their respective spots, right? You look at Kyle Lewis and where he's been able to be and be a mainstay in that third spot in the lineup, it puts everybody in their proper roles. Seager, Evan White, you know, Taylor Trammell, he was batting fifth. I mean, you're putting him, you know, towards the end of the lineup. I think it just puts you in a much better, healthier position overall for your entire lineup. And obviously, we're all excited to see the kid play. I mean, he plays with so much joy. He brings just an air of you know, fun when you watch him play and the way that he approaches the plate. And so I think that's a big, obvious missing piece to this. And, you know, as I watch this as well, I can't help but think of Kelnick, too,
his
talent. I mean,
yep.
You know, it's going to be one of those things that you're just going to be really yearning for that talent to eventually come up. It will happen this season. But excited for when that actually does.
Now, is there any part of either you, Jake, or you, Curtis, that actually expects the Mariners to bring up Kelnick before the next 21 days?
No. I don't see them bringing him up in the next 21 days.
Or 14, 16, whatever it is.
I don't think so.
Before the end of the month?
Before the end of the month.
I think they're going to try and get him some work against other teams down in Arizona because I believe those camps don't begin until about another week from today. Week from tomorrow, so there's still some time before we're going to see Jared Kelnick up here, which I got to be honest, like watching this offense over the first four games of the season, you can't tell me that these nine guys are better than Jared Kelnick is. You can't tell me that like he would not be better in this lineup than what we've seen so far.
I would sure like to hope not, right? I mean, obviously, if that is the case, then, you know, you have some concerns there. And he'll be, when he comes up, he'll still be a young player and you're going to give him some leeway to figure things out. But you're hoping that when he arrives, that he is able to, you know, talent wise, really make a difference for this club, especially at the plate. And to ensure that for Jerry Dipoto and Scott Servais, that is to make sure that he gets a full workload. You feel confident that he is ready to go. And I think that, look, I understand what they're doing. I think it's smart what they're doing, mm-hmm. ultimately. But you look at the lineup and you see the way that they've been performing the past couple nights at the plate. I think that these are the types of games last night against the White Sox that you look at and go, can't wait till you see that guy up on the lineup.
As a reminder for you guys, we've got Scott Servais joining us for the Scott Servais Show in about an hour, so we'll have a chance to ask him about Lewis and a few of these other guys. Also, we're taking you around the diamond thanks to the Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. It's the return of James Paxton. He'll make his debut in his second stint with the Mariners tonight against the Chicago White Sox. Pregame starts at 6 p.m. First pitch is at 7:10 p.m. on 710 ESPN Seattle. And that's Around the Diamond, brought to you by the Shane Company, your friend in the jewelry business. All right, switching gears here. The NFL draft, less than a month away now, and we're getting you ready by previewing some of the players who could be available to Seattle at number 56 overall. Cornerback, one of the team's weakest positions on defense right now, so why not take a look at a potential long-term answer? Seahawks draft profile is next. Don't go anywhere.